Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Thriving Adoptees podcast. So today I'm delighted to be joined by Richard Rose. Welcome to the show, Richard. Really looking forward to our conversation today.
Thank you very much, Simon. Me too.
Yeah. So Richard is an expert in life story work. So what we're going to do today is we're going to explore what that's about, because as Richard says, you know, the past can be a challenge in our can be a challenge for us in the present. The past that our kids have been through can be a challenge for them in the present. And when Richard said that, the first thought that came into my mind was this question that popped into my brain probably about 6 months ago, perhaps longer. And the question was, I'm 55, maybe 54 at that time when the question came up. And I was adopted 54, 55 years ago. And my level of security, my level of attachment, my general mood has varied very significantly over that time. So my experience of life has been variable, but the event of the past is fixed. So a fixed input cannot create in my mind, or in my logic, should I say, a fixed input, a fixed event cannot be the cause of a variable output. So perhaps a little bit left brainy way of taking this. So what my mind came to with that, my logic came to with that, was there must be some intermediary factor, must be something. It can't be the past that's determining my level of security in the moment, my level of fear in the moment. It kind of must be something else. And so we figured that that might be a good jumping off point for the conversation, because Richard has decades of experience in this work. And when I raised that question to him, he had the start of a really fruitful way of looking at this. So how can a past event — there must be something off with my question, I think, perhaps, Richard.
I'm not too sure off with the question is the right way, Simon. But if you think around the notion of our experiences and how we understand the world, when we are within our mother's womb, we are already beginning to make sense of who we are. And we can look at lots of different theory that might support that thinking. But the majority of that concepts are this internal working model, which was first brought concept in the late 40s, early 50s by John Bowlby. And I think that when we look at past and when we look at the impact of the past, we do have an understanding of that past, and we've resolved that understanding, i.e. we've accepted, you know, that it's a fixed event, that we can't change it, we can't rewrite it, then it is possible, I guess, to move forward in that kind of certainty. The difficulty is, of course, that when we're looking at adoption, we're looking at children who have often been through very difficult early life experiences. There's not an understanding of a fixed past. There's an understanding of an event or a series of events that have gone on to shape who that young person is. So again, without going into too much theory, but happy to later on if you wish to, but most people are aware of Bruce Perry, for instance. Bruce Perry is a foremost thinker around trauma on the brain, especially on the brain of the young child. And what he would say, along with many other neuroscientists, is that, you know, in the first 3 years of life, so when this child that, you know, we all care for has come out of their mother's womb, they're into the world, the next 3 years of their journey is really where their brain, the architect of their brain, is shaped by their experiences. So whatever's happening to them will result in the synapse connection, that, if you like, that linking up all the neurons, the worms, if you like, in our brain, so they connect the pathways. But they're all absolutely dependent on experience. The trouble is, of course, that most of our memories that we can verbally tell each other don't really kick in till about 5 years of age. So if you're looking after a young person in an adoption concept where you've had that child in your story and your family from, say, a year old, there are certain things that have already started to shape that young person that will stay within that young person and build on their systems. So Perry would say, for instance, the three-year-old, their core neural networks, so that's that middle kind of real important part of who we are, that reasoning, that moral, that clue setting has all formulated. And as the child grows, they build on that core neural network. And of course, if we're working with 15, 16-year-olds, we have an awful lot to get through to get to those core experiences. The thing that we were talking about was around that notion of if past is fixed, how does it impact on who we are in the present? But actually, most of the people that you and I will meet, including ourselves, we're all shaped by the events in our world. And we continue to manage those events by having, defense mechanisms or coping strategies that we use to navigate those instances in our world. The challenge for us, of course, is that our young children, they have learned to use these strategies. And sometimes those strategies have to be called on so many times in a very early stage of their development, they are no longer strategies, they're behaviors. And so when something happens, I know what to do because this keeps me safe, even if what they do isn't safe in itself. And we can go on and talk about that a bit later, I'm sure. If we think around the notion that most of us caring for children who are then going into adoption have had some form of trauma event that may have occurred that's warranted the need for them to be placed outside their family of origin, then we need to think about the notion of trauma. And a lot of our older children in adoption who have not managed to make sense of their past are often defined by that past. They're defined by that insecurity, by that feelings of, sometimes that overwhelming nature of what's lost. And so for me, when we work with trauma, we need to think around that fact that trauma isn't necessarily the event that took place, that fixed event. Trauma is unique to every single individual throughout the world. And it's unique because the concept of the trauma is the residual that's left after, i.e., we can all of us, witness the same event. And not one of us will have the same impact of that event kept within us. We will react differently. Some of us will shrug our shoulders. Some of us will keep seeing the event, keep thinking about it. Some of us will want to tell everybody about it. Some of us won't tell anybody about it. Some of us will, have to do something in order to help us to make sense of what we've seen. And others will just literally park it to one side. The problem, of course, is that the residual of trauma is the trauma that's not resolved. And the way we work with children is to actually make sense of that past, to help them to make sense of what happened, the reasons why it happened, the other people involved in the story of it happening. And the idea really is that children get to the point where they can actually understand what is mine and what is yours, i.e., it's not my fault. So we use the concepts of monsters and ghosts, which is what we were going into when we started the podcast as our kind of debating thing. Stephen King, not your average social care writer. Most of us know Stephen King for his horror books. He wrote a book called The Shining back in the 70s. And in The Shining, there's a quote which I use when I work with my teenage young people. And that is that monsters are real and ghosts are real too. They live inside us and sometimes they win. And if we actually look at that on a context of what we've just said, if you're a young person that's been living in a traumatic environment, say domestic violence, and you've experienced that violence from the womb, and you've experienced that violence in the first few months of life, you have to survive that violence. So you create ways in which you get your needs met. And important researchers such as Stansbury, for instance, would say that a young child who learns how to cope in a situation But that situation is over and over and over and over again. No longer learns to cope, they learn how to behave. And that could be very monstrous. That could be to hit, that could be to self-harm, that could be to run away, that could be to defend. And left unchecked, those behaviors then become a behavior they call upon the moment they sense danger, which will be well before we see danger, because their lives will depend on it. Whereas us as carers, we don't have that same mentality.
Is that what people call hypervigilance?
Well, hypervigilance is that notion of being mindful of who is around or what is around that could possibly do me harm. And how am I going to be ready to do it? So give an example of that for very young children. You may be a carer or an adoptive parent that has a child placed with you, and that child follows you around all the time. And it's almost like they're stuck to you. And even if they go to the toilet, you know, they want to know that you're there. They talk to you through the door. They want to know how long you're going to be. And it's thought that that's because children who have notions of, rejection or abandonment need to see you to feel safe. I would argue it's different. I would argue that here is a perfect example of keep your friends close, but keep your enemies closer. See, the closer I am to the adult that I know is going to hit me, because all adults have in the past, I now have slightly more opportunity to see when that's going to happen. And slightly more opportunity to get myself ready for it. And this we see in all walks of children's lives in care, where we have children who are vigilant to, who append to, who seek out those people that are, safe, those people that might be safe, those people that are unsafe. And depending on their learning, they may well want to be with a person that's unsafe, because that helps them to feel, in a strange way, safe.
Okay. On this notion, the word that you use of unresolved trauma.
Mm-hmm.
That on the face of it, that sounds quite a logical word. You know, resolving the trauma. You know, come to terms with it. Or mm-hmm. it sounds like it's fairly logical. But I would guess it's anything but. It is deeply emotional. Is that right?
It's often survival. That if I have a belief in me that I'm responsible for what happened to me, then I can survive. But if I'm getting told by somebody, actually, it wasn't you, it was your parent, or it was somebody that did things to you, that might actually be very difficult for me to make sense of. That might be, well, why on earth would a dad hurt me? It must have been my fault. I must have been a bad child. I must have been deserving of this in order for me to move to the next step to survive. So in a way, what you're looking at is an internal model which says I'm worthless. I'm unlovable. People in the world are dangerous to me. And what we're trying to do is to help turn that round to be a child that can say, I am worthy. I am lovable. People around me can be safe. And I have a place in the world that I belong. Yeah. So if you imagine having to change that whole core belief system round, therein lies the challenge, and therein lies that model that we use in this therapeutic life story work.
Yeah. I've read that book. Who's the guy? There's a British author that writes a lot about being lovable. His name escapes me at the moment. It seems to me that there's a lot of us feel, to some extent, unlovable. What mm-hmm. is there a vulnerability? Is there something that we can use from within
mm-hmm.
as adoptive parents to help our kids see that we empathize with them, and that we sometimes feel the same. Is that mm-hmm. a thing?
Yeah, it is a thing, because you're quite right that all of us at some point in our lives will start to question, am I okay? Did I make a difference? Do I have people in my world that care about me, that I care about them? And we'll have moments in our lives where maybe relationships go wrong, maybe our work life goes wrong, maybe our children become adolescents and they're in that stage where they don't want to know us anymore. That's that itself is always that time when we question, am I okay? Am I worthy? And if you're in a situation from a very young age where all those kind of experiences say, yes, you are unworthy, look, I don't feed you, I don't care for you, I don't nurture you, then the way in which an adoptive parent or a long-term carer could help is to be what we call consistent, predictable, and repetitive. So we use this notion, or it's my kind of work that I'm doing at the moment, on this notion that, you know, we have CPR when we have people who have heart attacks or have problem in their breathing. We should be using CPR for our attached challenge children, but our CPR is consistency, predictability, and repetition. So as an example, if anybody wants to, there's a video where I talk about internal working model using glasses of water, and they can access this on YouTube. Just look up Serve and Return by Richard Rose. But the point being that children who have been hurt or have an expectation that parents are dangerous will close themselves off to those parents' attentions because they're dangerous. So they'll survive by getting their immediate needs met, but they won't engage. They won't take risks with relationships. They will push carers away because they have this belief that those parents at some point will let them down, because that's their schema. So if you try to pour in love in a closed lid of, you know, if you imagine you've got a glass of water with a lid that's now closed, here's a carer pouring in water, pouring in their love, their essence, it's just going to go down the sides.
But that's what people call blocked care, yeah?
Pardon?
That's what some people call blocked care.
Some people call it blocked care. I mean, it's really about protection. You know, if you're somebody that knows and believes that adults will let you down, and then you take a risk to relate to that adult, and then they let you down, the next adult you meet, you're going to be a lot more wary, a lot more careful. And the easiest thing to do is just to not let them into your space. Now, the trouble here is, of course, that if these carers keep pouring, they themselves are going to empty out. And they'll say, I can't do this anymore. This child doesn't want me. This child's too difficult. And we have a placement breakdown. So what we help our carers in our therapeutic life story work to do is to be consistent, i.e., you know, this is tea time. This is bedtime. This is our process in our house that you understand. You can now predict that at this point, this happens. At this point, this happens. At this point, this happens. And repeat it and repeat it and repeat it. Eventually, what will happen is that child will start to think, okay, I can start to depend on these things happening around me. Their lid opens up a little bit. And this means that they're taking a risk. They say to the carer, accidentally often, I love you, or they give them a hug. And of course, once they've done that, they've now taken this risk because they've led themselves vulnerable. So they snap their lid back. And what that normally looks at is a child who says, oh my gosh, I'm at risk again. I have to hurt you as my carer. I have to do something that shows you I don't really care about you. So they might attack their carer. They might break something of their carers. They might tell their carer they hate them. They don't, of course, but all they're doing is trying to get back to be safe again. Now, if we work with children like this consistently, predictably, repetitively, this lid that comes up and snaps back, comes up and snaps back, will start to have less snapping back, more opening, as that carer becomes safe, predictable, reliable, responsive. And eventually, one hopes, that hypervigilance of will you, becomes a knowledge you will. And this is what we do in our work. It's why our work takes about 9 months, because we go into a relation to create that CPR, which then allows us to have critical conversations. Again, many trauma experts would say you can do whatever intervention you want, but unless you've got relationship, unless you have a kind of sharing lives, sharing stories approach, you won't make that much difference for children's long-term health and well-being.
Yeah, and I think that's the same for us as well with the healing spaces I've been in with other adults. It was nothing to do with adoption. It was people were bringing all sorts of challenges to the week that I spent. We started off by sharing our stories, you know, as we did it, and that, and then you see that. Well, this is when I really saw that. Most, how shall I put this? The people on that course, and a lot of people that I've met in other places, they don't think they're good enough either.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this idea, if we're just in our own heads, in our own hearts, we think, well, I came up with a metaphor for this. I love your glass metaphor. I came up with a metaphor for this a couple of weeks ago, right? And I've tried it with a few people. I said, the metaphor is that low self-worth is like ice cream,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's got a million flavors. So, yeah. So for some, it's for a lot of my mates have got their own businesses. So our vanilla, the vanilla ice cream, is our businesses aren't good enough,
mm-hmm.
Right? For some people, there's the chocolate ice cream of insecurity, which is we're not the right body shape,
mm-hmm.
But what I feel happens in our brains is because they're meaning making machines, they look at a feeling like insecurity, and they look to hang that on one peg,
mm-hmm.
And they hang it on the peg, or they label it with the ice cream of I'm adopted, or I'm too fat, or I'm too thin, or I'm not mm-hmm. tall enough, I'm not rich enough, I'm not loved enough. That's what seems to me, we create meanings and oversimplify things. And so for me, when I realized that other people who are non-adopted don't feel good enough either, it kind of loosened the rope that I had tied somewhere that my insecurities is related to me being adopted.
Yeah. I mean, I think you see again, because we all have to have a story that makes sense to us. That story itself can be shaped by society. It can be shaped by a group that we are going to adopt, or it can be a process where we develop what you're doing here within these podcasts. You know, you're actually giving up an opportunity for those people that are in similar situations to you, or who are adopting children who end up being 55-year-olds. And how do we learn from? How do we make sense of? But we are a society that likes to label. And if we label, then what we're actually doing is we're taking away that internal me into a space or an ice cream or a cupboard or a drawer, which then says, right, that's because I'm this way. And in some cases, that's actually a holding space. The difficulty is that space is never going to be big enough to hold you. And so sometimes you will burst out of that drawer. Sometimes things will get too big or too powerful for you that you almost have to declutter your drawer, which means that you jettison some of those ways you manage the world, and then you become undone. You become more insecure. I mean, a good way of thinking around it for me is that, you know, most social care workers, if you did an internal working model, we use a balance of the model, and you say to most social workers or care workers, if you were thinking about yourself, your internal view of self, which is the first model of Bowlby's internal working model, i.e. am I lovable, am I unlovable, am I worthy, am I unworthy, you just put both of them on the ends of a continuum line. And then you say to a social worker, where would you place yourself? Would you be nearer the worthy, or would you be nearer the unworthy? Most social workers will be nearer the unworthy. If you look at therapists, lots of therapists will have imposter syndrome. It's when you suddenly think, I don't really know what I'm doing. I'm not really any good. I'm not really. Business people who are very, very, successful are driven by the fact they're not good enough. Comedians will use comedy, will use that kind of self-deprecation to manage that internal strife. If you look at Hancock, for instance, if you look at Billy Connolly, if you look at those kind of people that talk about their early years and how that hurt, how that trauma, how that feeling of unloving or unlovable experiences have shaped their a journey through life to the point where they are just not good enough. So they push and they push. And just one more thing, for me, I train all over the world online, on face to face. And in the pandemic, a lot of my training has been online. And I would say to people who are not responding to me, hey guys, when you listen to me talk like we're doing now for an hour, and you don't say anything, you don't ask me any questions, I don't think, gosh, they're really interested. My first thought is, you don't like me. So I have to now pedal faster and do even more incredible things if I can to help you to like me. That's my internal working model. Now, we share adoption, you and I, but at the end of the day, that's also about, wanting to be wanted, wanted to be loved, wanted to be kind of championed. And most of our young children in adoption placements, that's all they want. They want to be loved. They want to be championed. But actually, if they try it with you, are you going to be the same as all my other experiences? And the only way they'll find out if you are going to be this wonderful holder of them is to actually be consistent, predictable, and repetitive.
Fascinating stuff. Because you've been, it's impossible to separate what some people call the primal wound and what's, what we see the trauma from neglect and abuse, right? In one person. It's not like it's like one of those it's not like a latte macchiato where you've got the white milk underneath and the brown coffee on the top. It is inseparable. It's more like when the latte is mixed up. When you especially when it's served, you serve it, some people serve it in Costa, they serve it in the glass and you can see the two levels. So it's impossible to separate out that stuff with within one person. I have so I was born. I think I was put into some short-term foster care by my birth mother. I was then collected at 5 weeks old from that foster mother and brought to the adoption council in Liverpool. And then that's where my mum and dad came and took me away from. So, to my knowledge, I wasn't subject to any neglect or. Abuse in those 5 weeks of my life. So if we're going to say, well, Simon's only got the primal wound, if that is a thing, you've got the which is another which is a question for another episode, I think. So that's my only lived experience is obviously pre-verbal and it's a primal wound. I've heard a lot about the abuse stuff, but I haven't got the lived experience. What? This is perhaps a self-indulgent question for me. Maybe you can turn it into something that actually adds value to the listeners. Do you see any differences between those people like me who have had one start and the other kids that have had a different start?
Well, I think that the first thing I'd say is that it doesn't really matter because you are unique and every child is unique. And so you can have children that go through extreme difficult traumatic experiences of violence, of a mother maybe using drugs and therefore the baby born with an addiction which then has to go through withdrawal, and all those things will impact on that child's development, just general development, that kind of health development. But the reality is that some children will kind of experience these things, but it will not continue to dominate who they are. But there will be moments in their lives where it may well become a challenge. you can have other children that are relinquished, you know, where there's not necessarily a trauma as such, but maybe, you know, there's pressure on the mother who's very young to, you know, put her child into an adoption process. But that's still a trauma. That's still a kind of impactful event. So the best way for me to explain it, I guess, is what I use with my training carers that I work with. If I was to ask you or any of the listeners here to think of the three most important things in your world, the three most important things, okay, and write them down. So for me, just so you know where I come from, well, my first would be my family. So my two boys, my wife. The second would be my health, which is very selfish, but I love my work. I love working with the young people I work with and families. I've done it for a very long time now. And I come towards the end of my career. So it's even more important at the moment. And then finally, again, ridiculous as it may sound, is my driving license. Because no children I work with happen to live near public transport, so it could be anywhere. Okay, so those are my three. If I was to think of the most important, it would be family. And if you were doing this and people around you were doing this, you'd probably end up saying the same thing. So now let's think, why am I saying this to you? Let's say I've got the authority, I've got the power to come into your house or into the houses of the listeners that are listening to this, and I take your family off you. What are you going to do?
Well, you're going to get angry, I guess, I think would be.
So some will get angry. Some will get
fighting.
Yep, some will fight. Some will be shocked. Some will be, you know, what have I done wrong? Others will, you know, start to try to make a reason for why this man's taken your family off you. But nobody's really understood or accept or helping you to make sense of it. The thing is that I've gone, I've taken your family. You're left with those emotions. What do you do with them?
Yeah. Well, I fester on them for a bit. I would guess. Yeah.
Could be lifetime.
Yeah.
Could be lifetime. So you're now. Let's talk about you, because your question was you. Okay. You were very, very young, born into the world, a foster placement, and then meet your adopted mum and dad. But you still aren't with your family of origin. Yet you're going to be at school with people that are with their family of origin. You're going to have this label. We talked about ice creams. You're an adopted child. That's going to be a label for you. There's this difference that you know that's not quite there, that doesn't quite make sense. And as you go through your life course, these things will come into your mind. These things will make you feel different. And the challenge for people like me is that if those young people don't understand why, don't understand the stories behind those reasons for them no longer living in their family of origin, then it always becomes something that even when they have their own children, will these be taken off me?
Yeah.
What if I'm not going to be a good enough parent? What if people might say, well, you're an adopted young person, you don't know family? So it's all these things that continue to shape. Now, the only other thing I can mention, Simon, I think it's worthwhile very quickly, another way of doing, not that, but something to explain it, especially for children who've had a number of first placements. Imagine a cup of water, which is the child, and then have about six or seven. I work with multi-placed children, but let's say six or seven cups. And each cup has got some water in it, and each cup has got a slightly different color water. Now, the cup that you start with is this, you know, non-color, this, you know, kind of, you know, non-descriptive, clear fluid. And your first placement's with your mum and dad. So you now share your life, share your stories. So let's say mum and dad was yellow. Now, when they share, this clear fluid is going to be tinged with yellow. And mum and dad's color is going to be slightly less yellow because they've got water in it now. The placement breaks down. Child goes to the foster placement. And let's say the foster placement's got blue color. So now the foster carer and you are going to share lives and experiences. Now, your slightly yellow is now going to have some blue in it. Now, if you carry on with different colors all the way through those movements to your final placement in adoption, as an example, let's say you're 4 years old, your, when you came into the world, this clear fluid is now a multitude of colors. And whoever's looking after you is also going to have those multitude of colors. So people like me come involved because we can separate out those colors. We can make sense of those colors. We can celebrate how those have shaped who we are. And therefore, it's no longer that, you know, I wonder why, is it me, was it my fault? They know their story. And by knowing their story, they can then start to know themselves. So we look at it this way. If my present is a result of my past experiences, but those experiences stop me moving to the future without being defined by the past, the work that we do says, okay, let's make sense of your past so we understand your present, and then we can help you to move into your own volition of future. And then that's really what life story work's about.
Yeah. So as you can say that, as you say all that, you share incredibly eloquently, I'm gonna need to listen back to that again, because I think what was going on for me was I was thinking about digging out my answer from what you just said, and what came to me was, and it's strange because you talked, it's about story work. So growing up, I had a book in my bookshelf called something like Mr. and Mrs. Fairweather or something. I can't remember what it's called. And it's a storybook about a couple that fall in love, get married, and then adopt a child. So I'm figuring that perhaps that, I'm pretty sure, I need to ask my mum this, I'm pretty sure that they read that to me before I could understand it and continue to read it to me. And, you know, I continue to have a look at in my bookshelf when I was able to read or whatever. So I figure out that was an early resolution of what you're doing. Because you said that you said something about multi-place kids. You said multiple placements. So you're working with kids that have been through far more challenges than I have, because I only went through the two cups and one of the
short. But Simon, I mean, you know, you can only go through two cups and still be as confused and as kind of impacted as a child has had 8, 10, 12 placements. So we often work with children where there's been a very smooth transition from family of origin to placement. A young girl I've been working with a few years back now, who's just wonderful, she had the same experience that you had, in a way that she was removed from her family of origin at birth. She was placed in a foster home for a short period of time, and then she was placed with adoption parents. But at 9 years old, she's attacking her adopted parents. She is confused about who she is. Now, she has a book, but the book was done when she was a year old. The book doesn't tell her anything other than mummy was poorly, daddy had got angry sometimes. But the pictures are smiley mummy, smiley daddy. And she doesn't have any kind of connection to her story, because it's a story that's being given to her. Now, in the UK, in England, Wales, there is a legal requirement that all children have a life story book. But those life story books are often written, you know, not with the child, but actually for the child, for them around about the age of 4 or 5. But you see, when you're 7, Vera Faubourg's your person here, when you're 7, who am I? When you're 11, who am I and who are you? And when you're 13, who am I and who the hell are you?
Yeah.
And each of these concepts are when we start to question ourselves, who we are. And so those books, those early books, although they're kind of, you know, easy reading, they don't always tell the story. So this little girl, this 9-year-old, who was attacking her adopted parents, she wasn't really attacking her adopted parents because she didn't love them, she didn't want them, she didn't want to be with them. What she was doing was trying to work out, am I safe? If I do this, will you keep me safe? She was having difficulty at school, and so where she needed to be was her safe place. So life story work, even though she hasn't had this massive trauma, she is still impacted by her journey. She's still different. Back to your ice creams, she's still a different flavor. And what she hasn't understood is that flavour that she has can be a wonderful flavour if everybody else understands her story too.
Yeah. So there's no logic to this stuff at all.
As in,
no predictability. It's as you say, it was the number of placements, the extent of the neglect. It doesn't count.
Well, it counts, but trauma and the child or the young adult that's involved, they're unique. And so the way they've understood, the way they've made sense, the way that they have found peace or not peace is a unique space. I'll give you an example. You often have 12-year-old girls, 13-year-old girls going into puberty. You know, their body's getting ready for parenthood, for motherhood. And then they read their book that they had done when they were 1 year old, which says, Mummy was poorly, so you had to live with a new family. Yeah? Well, what if I get poorly? You know? Or they know a mum couldn't care for them because mum had a mental health problem. And they're, as a 12-year-old, are seeing CAMS, you know, child mental health services. Well, then they're going to take my baby off me. But they haven't got anywhere to ask. And so this internalizes, it becomes bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And all of a sudden, you've got a very different world. So, you know, it's not that it's no logic. It's just that if we understand that, you know, go back to that, your three most important things. And if we all say in that three, often the most important is family. And we have taken that very, very important part away from a child and we give them a new family. How do they know that that new family is the right family? What about the old family? Do they still think of me, love me? Do they care about me? What about the people that they, you know, do they have other children that I'm related to, you know, and all these questions fest. So we started, you know, when we met each other online and we both shared the fact we're both adopted. I'm from a big family. And there were four of us that were adopted by our father. And my sister, my older sister, she is someone that's gone through an awful lot of challenges, and she has had to know everything about her family of origin, whereas I don't, and I don't know who my natural father is, and I do my work, I do, but I'm not, you know, I don't need to know. Do you see what I mean? But you would think doing this work, I need to know. No, we're all unique, and therefore the way in which we cope with our stories and the way in which we cope with the world around us is very much around that notion of who am I? How do I fit? And for me, it goes all the way back to that internal working model.
Yeah. How, I want to take you back a 10 minutes, so, because you were talking about our own understanding. So our own grounding, our own, you know, so I heard something fantastic this morning. You know, we can only change ourselves, right? So
yes,
as an episode, one of the most impactful interviews I've done for the podcast was a adoptive mum called Holly Petri, who runs an agency in the States. They got nine kids or something. I always forget how many. She came up with the podcast. A topic for the podcast, which was unpacking our own baggage as adoptive parents.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And that for me was a beautiful piece of self-awareness on her part. So what comes to mind when I share that with you?
Well, it's basically the reflection that that's exactly what we do with our young people. We declutter. You know, imagine you've got this space in your brain which holds your memories, you know, your hippocampus, and you've got all the spatial concepts of you know, your kind of fight flight systems that have either been acted or are reactive, etc., etc. And then, you know, you've got all these things that have happened in your past you can't talk to anybody about. So again, in adoption, for instance, a lot of children won't ask their adoptive parents because they don't want to upset their adoptive parents if they're thinking about their family of origin, you see. And so they hold all this stuff in their heads, and they become very, very preoccupied. So what that means is they haven't got much left to their day-to-day living. So again, I know I use glasses a lot, so let's use another glass just as an example. You and I talking now, yeah, we're multitasking. We're thinking about the past. We're being flooded by our memories, yeah. But we're managing to hold that at a level maybe of 30 or 40% of remembering now, preoccupation. But we still got 70% that we can have this conversation reasonably well. We can hold our emotions. We can, you know, think. We can reflect. We can make sense, hopefully. Okay. But what about the child that's actually thinking in their space about mum and dad and their brothers that don't live with them anymore and the new baby that's coming to the family that can live with mum? They're thinking about how their friends see them and how they see their friends. And so their preoccupation in their glass might be 80%. That means they've only got 20% to manage the class. Yeah. And so, again, if you think about going through life like this, you learn how to manage. The trouble is you never be all you can be because this is stopping you doing that. So our work and the way in which I guess my best example of how we do this work is in that decluttering is that we say to children, okay, well, look, why don't we, and we use wallpaper, so this is wallpaper, like a tapestry. Why don't we talk about all that stuff that's preoccupying you and we'll take it from your everyday brain and we'll put it onto this paper where it can be safe. And if you imagine that children who do this, what happens is that preoccupation, that 80%, gets lower and lower as they declutter, as they, you know, make sense of who they are, like your carer talked about. And what that means is then that all that kind of preoccupation becomes less and less and less, which allows your child to be occupied in their present. So what we see in our work is children and young people start to make a friend, start to do better at school. We just had research that's just been published, which, you know, kind of suggests that when you do this kind of decluttering, if you like, this kind of not cleaning out, but making sense and then placing it somewhere where we can, you know, see it, hold it safe, but not carry it. Then children who are, you know, all the children I were incredibly intelligent, but they use their intelligence to keep safe. Once they realize they don't have to be wary, hypervigilant, cautious, that they can embrace the world in the present, we see growth and development. The life story books we do is this, then written out. So again, if I can just take a minute, if you imagine your carer that spoke about, you know, having to make sense of who she is in order to feel comfortable in her own space to care for children. In a way, what we're doing with our young people is we're helping them to make sense of their journey, their past, their experiences, their hurts, their strategies. Create a way in which we could hold all that safety for them, which we use this wallpaper idea as a tapestry of their life. So imagine that we have grandparents to parents to their conception to their birth to their journey in care to adoption to the current day. They then have all this stuff, which is an everyday thought, but it's a place in which they can go to when they need to. Like you said, that little book about your parents, that they had a baby, you can go to, oh yes, that's where it happened. Oh yes, that's what it means. Oh yes, it's okay, we're all right. And that's what we do. That's the work we do. So I'll give an example very briefly. The 80% child that I was referring to, she was worried about her mum who drinks alcohol. She would care for her mum. She was there looking after mum and her sisters. She's been in care for 3 years. Her fear is the police are going to come and tell her mum has died. And it'd be her fault because she wasn't at home looking after mum. She's worried about her baby brother who's adopted. She's in care. And if he's adopted, does he think about her? Does he know about her? Does she know he's safe or not? So she has him in her head all the time. Her dad, who's in prison, coming out of prison. All these layers, up to 80% of her, you know, her waking life is already preoccupied. We helped her to reduce all these by answering these questions, by making sense, by understanding. And that was when she was 12 years old. She's now a senior manager in a social work department in the north of England. Always was clever, but her need to keep safe meant that she couldn't engage in the now because the past was overwhelming her. So that very long-winded answer to you, if we can help children to declutter, we can give them space to grow.
Yeah. So how would, as you were talking, I was thinking about the overload and overwhelm I see in parents a lot, right? Mm-hmm. So I haven't got any kids, but a lot of our friends have. And, you know, like I go swimming, I'll be going swimming shortly. And at the moment we're in the summer holidays and parents are overwhelmed as they were mm-hmm. with COVID. You know, it's like, what do we do with the kids? How do we can? So there's lots of kids in the swimming pool, right? So how does, so most parents listening, I am sure, feel overloaded and overwhelmed mm-hmm. and have a feel a distinct lack of capacity in their brains most of the time because they're trying to sort out logistics and they're trying to sort out their kids, they're balancing work. So they're familiar with all that. And I'm wondering to what, and this is a naive question, intentionally so. How does the overwhelm that parents are familiar with that are listening, how does that compare to the overwhelm that's going on in one of these kids?
Well, I mean, again, you know, there's lots of theory that would suggest that we often as parents reflect our children. So if our children are very, very kind of preoccupied, we also become very, very preoccupied of their preoccupation. And that means that not only are we dealing with the day-to-day life of a parent, the day-to-day life of an adult in this very difficult world that we live in, you know, whether it's pandemic, cost of living, all these other bits and pieces. And so imagine your own glass of water, you know, how full is it of things that you can't control? And once you understand how full it is, then you can make yourself a list. And so what we do, and I do this when I work with my young people, I'm very busy like many people, and I know I get overwhelmed sometimes. So what I do is I recognize that my cup is just overflowing or dangerously near the top. So I'm more likely to get angry, more likely to become snappy, more likely to not suffer too much patience. And so what I do is I write out all those things that are preoccupying me. And I actually put them onto a separate piece of paper. So like, you know, I put them on a separate piece of paper. Now, that might sound a bit strange. And how does that help? But actually, it helps immensely. Because what it says is, look, I'm overworked. I'm overwhelmed. I'm overcooking because of all these things that I'm trying to deal with in my brain. But if I externalize it to paper, if I externalize it to a list, I can then prioritize that list. I can start to say, well, look, actually, this isn't that important. It's getting in the way of me. So, for instance, you know, arranging for the child to go on a play date or arranging for the child to go to, you know, a particular event. Well, actually, you know, some of those things are very simple to resolve, but not when you've got everything else happening in here. So by just taking it out. And the way I liken this, Simon, is that I'm awful. I'm married to the most wonderful person, blah, blah, blah. But I'm the one who does the shopping. And she'll write me a shopping list. I'll guarantee you I've lost the list before I get to the shop. Okay. And so I'm in the shop now thinking, what was I supposed to buy? I buy too much. I buy far too much because I don't want to get in trouble for forgetting something. But if I had my list and I knew what I was getting, I now have the capacity left to look for offers, to enjoy the process. Do you see how that works? And so in reality, for me, I go and see children and I need to be available to them. I can't have my stuff and be available to them. So in my car, I have a pad of paper and I write all the things that are in my head at that moment. I then leave the list on my car seat. I go in and see my young people. And for that moment, I'm no longer juggling, overwhelmed. And that's a really good practical way of dealing with it.
Yeah.
Writing lists, it might sound strange, but actually all it's doing is it's reordering for you what's going on and it gives you space for the moment.
Yeah. And it relates back to what you were saying about You said something about decluttering. It's not removing, so
No.
it's not going to the tip with
No.
our rubbish. It's putting all the stuff in the right in the right shelves, in the right cupboards. In a
It's yeah, I mean, in a way, I mean, we use wallpaper because what we're saying to our children is you can't rewrite your past, you can write your future. So how do we make sense of the present? So the wallpaper is doing that. The wallpaper is saying, you know, this is me. These are my feelings. These are things that get me angry. These are things I'm good at. These are things that I wish I could do. These are things I regret doing. This is about my mum, my dad, my grandparents. This is why I came into care. This is why I live in an adoption. All that stuff is it's a bit like like the Bayeux tapestry. So it's written out, it's drawn out, it's words and pictures. And what that means is I no longer have to hold this here. A child said to me once, that means I don't have to carry it around anymore, Richard. And I'm saying, yeah, it's safe. It's safe here. And this stays with our children. They add to it during the sessions and between sessions. And then we write an actual book, which is often around 100 pages long or so. And that book then is their book, edited by them. It engages their story. It won't have everything that they've done on here. It will have the bits that they feel are important to have reference. What it also is a passport to the future. I understand. Now, the other thing to add to this, just to throw it in really, is that we also urge our adopted parents to do All About Me books with their children every 6 months, which is another way of decluttering. Now, an All About Me book, they can get it's all free on the website. So again, if you want me to I'll give you the details, or you might want to later on, Simon. But the All About Me is a booklet which carers fill in with their young people, and it is just my favorite things, my favorite color, who I live with, my family of origin, where I go to school, those wonderful little things. And they do that every 6 months. So let's say you've got a child who comes into care at a year old, like you, yeah, 5 weeks old. Your mum and dad write a book about who you are and what you like doing, you know, the music that calms you. 6 months later, another one. 6 months later, another one. 6 months later, another one. At 18 years of age, you've got 36 20-page booklets. Put together is your journey through care. So in Oregon, on the west coast of America, Oregon DHS, every child who's in care is now doing All About Me books. In Australia, in an organisation called MacKillop, every child's doing All About Me books. And in the UK, we've just finished a major project in the northeast of England, where every child has had the chance to do an All About Me and creative All About Me book. And if you imagine you and I'm 57, you're 55, is that right? 54, 55? Yeah. Imagine if we had in our journey through care, so from 0 to 18, or me 5 to 18, all the things that I managed to achieve, all the things that I liked, all my friendship changes, music changes, eating changes, achievements, disappointments, all there for me, written with me. I don't ever have to wonder what happened to me. I've got mine. And that's what we want to do in this life story process.
And this is all on the TLSWI.com website. Is it a different one?
That's right. So they go to TLSWI.com, go to the training page. You will see membership. That's not for people visiting the site. We have a community of practitioners. But if they just go to training, go right the way through the training. Don't worry about reading that unless you're interested. And at the bottom, you've got resources, and there you'll find All About Me. You'll get the videos of me talking about life story work. You'll get the video of the glasses around attachment. And it's all a really good resource. And of course, if people want to, they can email me and talk to me about anything particular that might be a concern.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. Is there anything else that you'd like to share before I bring this in?
I think what I would say, just for the UK, we have what we call the Adoption Support Fund, which is a fund by central government that's there to support young people who are struggling in adoption or in special guardianship. And it means that they can go to the adoption agencies that were involved in the placement of their children, and they can ask for help. And the government, central government in England, and what England only, unfortunately, moment, they give about £5,000 per year year on year to support children in adoption where adoption is challenging. And what we're seeing now is other organisations looking at similar ways in which they can provide this life story approach or these interventions. So I think that, you know, it is a thing to go to government with. So those of your audience in the United States, for instance, or in Australia or other areas, you know, do see what your local authorities, your departments, your human services are doing, and see whether or not it's something that can be collectively delivered. We share our practice. We don't sell our practice. So, you know, we can help one child, it makes a difference.
Yeah. Brilliant. Thanks a lot, Richard. It's been fantastic. Really enjoyed the conversation. And thank you
for the opportunity.
Thank you. And thank you, listeners, for listening again. And we will speak to you very soon. Thanks a lot and goodbye.